it's regular temperature, and they just use the magnetic fields and that spin echo effect to read it. Yes, they definitely do other elements, but I'm not familiar with exactly which ones. But so many elements, so many molecules contain hydrogen. Anything that contains that, they can do it.
I have a comment on that. The military experiment from 1982 or 1987 that I have spoke to you on the Technet before, which was the manganium replacing iron on the certain frequency. The frequency was a very, very much narrow frequency. It was 415 megahertz, and it was 555 megahertz. That was one of the experiments. I have in front of me the Czech patent that is working with the nuclear magnetic resonance using the natural magnetic field of the air, and this one is working on 172.753.867, so it would be 172 megahertz, 753 kilohertz, and 867 hertz. Back to you.
Hard for me to understand this a little bit. I can see why hydrogen would be chosen, because a human body contains a whole lot of hydrocarbons. In other words, the real organic chemistry, there's hydrogen atoms all over the place. But there's carbon atoms all over the place, and there's oxygen atoms all over the place. If I wanted to image a carbon atom or an oxygen atom, what's your guess as to what I would do differently? Why would I have to cool the material to look at an oxygen atom or a carbon atom instead of a hydrogen atom? You might have an answer on that one, John. K2RIW.
Dick, from what I understand, it's just a question of money. It's cheaper to use cryogenics because they need less equipment to do the same job that we're doing on the human body. And as far as I know, the only reason they're using that in the human body is because they don't have to freeze them.
Why would I have to freeze the carbon or the oxygen to image it? Why couldn't I get an MRI image of, let's say, a carbon molecule instead of a hydrogen molecule? Over to you, John.
I know they do it with carbon. I do not know the reason, Dick. I haven't researched that. I've just been heavily into the hydrogen and MRI.
So to your knowledge, you can image a carbon, but it takes cryogenics of the instrumentation or cryogenics of the sample material?
Material.
So for some reason, the sample material has to be cryogenically cooled. Is that because the carbon is, maybe the carbon is vibrating too much in space and gives you a blurred image until you slow it down in temperature? Is that what's going on?
You might be right, Dick. It may be the activity, because what they want to do is align the domains of those elements. You have the, if you looked at that diagram they showed you, they have a high level and a low level, and the spins are up and down. And what they want to do is try to get as much spin up, which is the low position for hydrogen, to examine it. Now, maybe with carbon, it's easier to do that and achieve that with maybe lower magnetic fields. I'm not sure, but that's all part of that reason, because they must align them to be able to control the spin, to get everything to spin in the right direction, to get the spin echo effect.
I agree with him. Let's say the spin echo spectrum at 4 to 2 Kelvin at ferrite crystal shows a very broad line extending from 300 to 470 megahertz, which has been identified as a manganium ions replacing iron on then 555 megahertz and then 585 megahertz, which have been identified as a manganium ions replacing zinc in the single crystals of the planar hexagonal ferrite compound, which was barium, zinc, Fe it will be ferrous, the manganium and oxygen bacteria.
Yeah, let me backtrack a little bit. What are we doing to those hydrogen atoms when we put them in a strong magnetic field and then we give them a blast of a couple hundred megacycles? Somehow we line them up in a particular direction, and then as they relax and go back to their natural position, is that what creates the emission that we read? Is that approximately what's going on, John?
Negative, Dick. We align them primarily to get it either spin up or spin down. Then they hit it with a magnetic field, is a different magnetic field from the alignment field, to cause the protons to tilt over. As they tilt over, they start to precess. We want to have them precessing in the XY direction, if that's the table. They're normally in the Z position when they hit it with the pre-magnetizing pulse. Then they hit them with that second pulse, it lays over, it's almost horizontally, and it's spinning around. The same coil that they use to create the tilt is also a detector coil, so it's turned on and off, pulsing and detecting, and that goes back to the computer for the reading. So they are reading, it's spinning around in a circle along the plane of the table, and then, like you said below, it starts to relax, it starts to return to that neutral position, and before it does, they give it another shot, and that's what they're detecting, the rotation or the spin of that proton. And then they use a spin echo effect, which is crossing over at 180 degrees of the rotation to cancel out the spread effect, and that's how they get an exact pulse.
In other words, it's as much as you can tilt Z to XY pattern, the better the effect you have. Do you agree with that, John?
Well, you get a higher induced voltage in the detecting coil.
When they take the axis of the spin that normally is Z, and they bring it down to the XY plane, does it then precess from X to Y to minus X to minus Y and back to X and so on? Is that the way the precession takes place? And does it stay there for a while and then go back to the normal Z? Back to you, John.
Exactly as you explained the gyro, it's standing vertically in the Z direction. As we tip it over, it starts to precess. We want to tip it as far as we can so it's precessing almost like a wheel on an axle, and it's riding on the table. And then it will slowly return back to the Z position. In its maximum deflection is where we get the maximum induction into the detecting coil. Does that sound clear to you?
I think so. And when you bring that spin axis from Z all the way down to X, does it then precess the axis of the spin? Does it precess from X over to Y and keep going in that direction to minus X and keep going in that counterclockwise direction to minus Y and then back to plus X again? Is that the way it's precessing, John? Go ahead.
That is correct, Dick. If it was the Earth, the North Pole is straight up. When they tilt it over, it starts to precess. They tilt it more and more until it's now at 90 degrees. The North Pole is now rotating around the XY, positive, negative, all the way around. As it slowly does that, it starts to return to its neutral position again. Then they whack it again to tilt it back over to the flat table position for its axis. And it is precessing.
So the axis of spin, if you did it with the Earth, it starts off at the North Pole, you bring it down to the equator, and then does it precess by continuously moving along the equator in either an easterly direction or a westerly direction? Is that the axis of spin precessing? Over to you, John.
Yes, if we look from the top, as it tilts over, you start to get your precession, and then as it tilts more and more until it's lined up with the XY pattern, then if you're looking at that globe, the North Pole would be inscribing a circle on the table in the XY position, constantly turning around. Then that circle would get smaller as the Earth returns back up into its normal position, pointing straight up in the Z. Okay?
Yeah, as it slowly returns, it's tracing out a spiral on the surface of the Earth. The axis of spin is tracing out a spiral. Go ahead.
Yes, it would definitely be a spiral because it is returning to its neutral position, so it would be a closing spiral as it's coming up. And it's an opening spiral as it goes down. Perfect picture.
And the rate of spiraling stays constant. That's characteristic of that particular hydrogen atom in that particular strength of magnetic field?
Yes, it does. And in New Zealand, the precession was 2.4 kilohertz. Now, it's different because of the effects of gravity, and that's why they have what they call a gradient coil. There's three coils in this device, a detecting coil, a gradient coil, and a pulse coil.
And the pulse coil gets pulsed with what kind of a signal?
The pulse coil basically gets a large DC voltage, and it instills a tremendous amount of magnetic field, which overpowers the Earth and the mixed spins of the element, because they're all spinning different, they're all over the place. Once it's aligned, they take their positions either in the high level or the low level. They're pointing up or pointing down. They want to look at the ones that are pointing up. So the big, large coil on the outside provides that magnetic field only for maybe 5 seconds, 10 seconds. Then the interrogating coil, which is the inner coil, is the one that tips it over to start the precession. And then they have what they call a gradient coil, which they can adjust, fine-tune, to cancel out nearby metal objects, the Earth, even though we think it has a homogeneous field, it doesn't. It can vary even within 1 foot, enough to upset this thing. That's why they have to have this gradient coil, they call it.
And I think you're saying that's done at 5 seconds. Wow. And then the pulsing is done at what rate? It sounds like a very slow imaging process.
It really is. That's why those machines run very slowly. As you notice, as the body is inserted into the machine, it's taking those slices, and each time it moves maybe a millimeter, well, no, probably a little more than that, probably about 10 millimeters in a shot, and it's taking that picture, each one takes a finite time, and that's due to that they have to keep the spins going and also record the imaging, and it's done on a line-by-line basis into a matrix. The imaging is very complicated. I don't understand the imaging yet, but that's due to spin echo. Very complicated stuff.
The whole machine has an extremely strong magnetic field. I am guessing the lines of force of that magnetic field go straight down the axis of the center of the hole of the machine. In other words, the main magnetic field, I presume, lines up with the major foot to head to toe axis of the human being. Is that approximately true?
Negative. I think the coil, which I believe is 1.5 to 3 Teslas, that is approximately 3 foot in width. And it's approximately, the inner part of that donut is probably 30 inches, and the thickness of the coil, of the ones I've seen, around 18 inches. But 1.5 to 3 Teslas, that's an enormous amount.
Yeah, but what's the orientation of that cryogenically cooled, steady state, let me pick a number, 3 Tesla, 2 Tesla magnetic field? The lines of force of the magnetic field go through the human body in what direction?
I believe it's head to toe for the alignment.
Okay. So in other words, the main magnetic field is going down the center of the hole of the donut where the human being is about to be translated through.
That's correct. That is correct. That's the, according to the study I've done, that is the pulse that is put on for the 5 or 10 seconds, supposedly to align all of those elements at the point where the imaging is going to take place. That's how they start that. And then you're moved in incrementally. But it's not doing the whole body at one time.
I accept that. But I'd like to believe the main cryogenic coil is producing a nearly steady state, very strong magnetic field. And then you're modulating that field above and below that magnitude by your electromagnetic coils. The main cryogenic coil is producing a steady state, tremendous magnetic field. Isn't that true?
Well, that's only turned on for 5 seconds for that one little individual slice. Then it's turned off. Then the gradient coil and the interrogating coil take over. And this is a simplified description, of course, Nick. There's a lot more to it. It's three coils, and that's basically how it works.
Hold on now. I'm led to believe that the main cryogenic coil runs steady state. Obvious by the fact I've seen people throw magnetic objects into one of those machines. That wasn't being pulsed. That was steady state. That's what I'm led to believe, John. Go ahead.
You're absolutely right, Dick. I've seen that. And that's when they turn it on, and they don't have it pulsing. They just turn it on, and you'll see them throw fire extinguishers and all kinds of stuff on you. And you're very strong.
Something else is bothering me, and that is if the machine loses cryogenics, the magnetic field caused by the cryogenics becomes quenched. And the quenching process, if it's done careful, not done carefully, a tremendous amount of magnetic field is about to collapse, and it can do damage. I think the main cryogenic magnetic field is essentially steady state if you don't get a quenching event. That's my belief, John. Go ahead.
Dick, you may be right, but the instructions and the operations of the device I was studying, it's not left on. It's only 5 seconds, then it's off, then the other two coils take over. Then it comes back on again to polarize again, and it just keeps doing that. And its main thing is to provide homogeneity for the magnetic field and to cancel out some of the Earth's magnetic field only in the beginning, and then the other coils take over. And I believe that's why you hear that bang, bang, bang. I'm sure you've heard those things in the room.
And another comment is there is no cryogenic present in the experiment from New Zealand.
If the coil that produces the very strong magnetic field is cryogenically cooled, and you set up a current in it which creates the magnetic field, that current can run through there forever as long as you're cryogenically cooled. I'm having trouble believing that that coil is cryogenically cooled and then you're pulsing the current on and off. If you're opening up contacts on that coil in order to induce a steady state magnetic current, field, whatever, I can't believe that those opening and closing contacts are also cryogenic. So something is bothering me here. I'm led to believe that once you charge the machine by cooling the coil with the liquid helium, liquid nitrogen, I think it's liquid helium, you cool the coil, set up the magnetic field, and I'd like to believe that as long as the machine is going to be used for the next week, when you stop using it at 8 o'clock at night, you keep the coil cryogenically in temperature because you don't want to go through that whole re-cooling process again in the morning, and I think the main magnetic field is there all night long. That's my guess. Over to you, John.
Again, Dick, you might be right. I don't know the switching arrangement, whether the main cryogenic coil is inductively coupled to a supply, therefore they could turn it off and on very easily. But the machine that I've been studying was not cryogenically cooled. It was a simplified version. But they did mention that the ones that they use in hospitals are cryogenically cooled, but that also helps with imaging for some reason when they do that. The coil structure seems to behave better. So you may be right. Maybe they do leave it on cryogenically, but I know that coil is not left on. The big magnetic coil is pulsed on and off to get the direction of the spins.
A lot more I got to know about this machine. Okay.
If you don't mind, I would like to ask you, finish the subject that we spoke about.
Okay, go ahead.
There is a, I believe, certain hole in physics, or at least I don't understand something. The halfway receiving antenna, a resonant, in that antenna, the resonant atom acts as if it has the expanded it in size to fill the entire near field region in terms of a quantum mechanic. It does so by locally creating a large virtual proton, AC field, which normally would not exist. And because the coherent superposition, in a sense, this new field becomes the antenna. The significant part of the new field extends, say, pi times wavelength divided by 2, that would be the distance around the atom, and then this distance can be 1,000 times larger than the atom radius. So one angstrom atom will, with the large AC field, can behave as one-third wave antenna at optical frequencies. And this teeny atom can absorb long wave radiation such as light, because we were talking about the atoms. So the one angstrom becomes a black sphere, then the 2,000 angstrom across, and efficiently absorbs 6,000 angstroms light waves. That would, I seem to be kind of strange, and that would be never encountered such as the thing during the, that what I think should happen. So I believe I'm missing certain details of the absorption of the light wave by atoms in whole.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So when the atom absorbs the wave, it has to scatter away half of the energy. So that doesn't mean that when atom absorbs a proton, it must always interact with two protons, eating one or reflecting the other. I didn't hear that would happen. I didn't read about it, but it flies into the face of a certain usual description of the atoms and photons. I was reading the Feynman book. I'm trying to find that, but what is happening? Enter again. Energy suction effect is not limited to the atoms, and we can build a device to demonstrate that phenomenon, I believe. I'm having problem how the teeny atom can suck energy from the long light waves, trying to understand how it works. You can hear me because I hear the carrier.
Don't worry, I'm hearing everything on the input, Wes.
Okay. So suppose we transmit a very low frequency radio signal at 1 kHz frequency. Let's say set the signal strength so it's about the same strength as the Earth weak vertical E field. Let's say 100 volts per meter. If the transmitter E field is contained entirely below the conductive ionosphere, and if the bottom of the ionosphere is about 100 kilometers high, then the Earth's entire vertical field is about, say, 10 megavolts top to the bottom. So our transmitter must produce a such field. And these values are totally ridiculous. The large, well-designed Tesla coil commonly produced 10 megavolts. So if such coil was erected outdoors and connected to an insulated metal tower, it would fills the Earth's entire atmosphere with 1 kilohertz radiation. So the Earth atmosphere would be like a microwave oven cavity, such as a sea voltage field would produce a feasible 100 volts per meter field everywhere in the Earth's surface. And this field would be detectable by, let's say, instruments, I don't know what instruments, but otherwise it would be too small for the humans to notice, as we certainly would not expect to be able to get significant power out of it. I'm trying to draw the picture, but I don't know if you are able to image it in your brain.
You've got me on this one, Wes. What's happening at the molecular level with light waves that are many, many times bigger than those molecules, I'm not sure. What's happening with the E field between ionosphere and Earth, I think I've got a little bit of better of a picture on that one. A Tesla coil, by the way, that can make 1,000,000 volts, I accept that. Except for that really big Russian machine that I've seen in one of the YouTube videos, I'm having trouble believe that there are any reasonable-sized Tesla coils that can produce 10 megavolts. Have you seen a picture of one that claims to make 10 megavolts? Because if it did, that would make an arc that's almost a mile long in theory, and I just don't think any of the machines I've seen can do anything like that. Over to you, Wes.
I don't know if I've seen that because I know the energy level of that Tesla coil, but I'm trying to drive to the capacitive plate antenna. And we got a feasible AC field in outdoor environment. How will a simple antenna plate perform as the energy receiver? That would bother me. If the large horizontal metal plate about 1 meter off the ground will give us a 100 volt signal at 1 kilohertz, but the 100 volt power source has an extremely large capacitive series of impedance. So let's say the plate ground capacitance is 10 picofarads, so then to draw the energy from the maximum possible voltage, the load resistor should be approximately equal to the series impedance. And this impedance is dominated by, let's say, 10 picofarad capacitor value, so it gives, let's say, okay, 1 divided by 2 pi, let's say it's 16 mega-ohm load resistor. And it drags the antenna voltage down to, let's say, 100 volts, from 100 volts to 70 volts. Then the received energy in the resistor is 300 microwatts. And the current in the resistor is in the microamp range. Just as we might expect, everything here is similar to the conventional radio antenna. And the point is that the weak E field from the incoming electromagnetic waves behaves only as the signal, and it is not a source or a significant power, and it cannot drive a motor or light or LED. I mean, if you're understanding me at that point.
Yeah, I think you're leading me on this one. I'm not quite sure I'm understanding it, Chris.
The fundamental problem with this is that the empty space around the metal plate is acting like a voltage divider. So the sky has a 10 megavolts compared to the ground, and if the metal plate is a few feet above the surface of the ground, then the plate only has a relatively thin voltage. So the current is teeny, so the wattage is also teeny, and maybe we could power the LED flasher with this antenna, maybe not, but only if we set it to flash every few minutes. Maybe we erected an enormous antenna tower
we would be better lifting the plate higher from the ground, but with such a huge antenna, we could easily steer more power by ignoring our 101 kilohertz broadcast, because the many high power conventional AM signal stations exist, like the radio stations. Do you know what I'm saying?
Let me jump over to something that's close to what I think you're saying. I know that Tesla set up this huge tower out in Manorville at his laboratory, and he did intend to transmit power wirelessly. Was his method of transmitting power, did he intend to locally light up the ionosphere, and then, let me pick a number, 500 miles away, set up a similar tower and tap the energy back down from the ionosphere? Was he intending to use the ionosphere as a detector, as a conductor between point A and point B, as a method of transmitting power wirelessly?
Yeah, there was a capacitive plate antenna that he was creating, isn't it?
You could call it a capacitive plate antenna, or you could call the ionosphere as one great big conducting sphere 100 kilometers above the Earth, and he intended to excite it in one spot and pick up the energy at some other spot without it being lost around the whole darn Earth at the same time by lightning and everything else. I think the losses, if he could have lit up the ionosphere in his intended way, I think the losses around the whole Earth would have been huge. That's my guess. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
I believe I agree with you. It makes a lot of sense what you think. I was thinking about antennas from quite unusual perspective, trying to understand them not from the traditional standpoint, not from the way that we usually talk about them. And when I, let's say, was thinking about the resonant antenna, I was saying, okay, we have a resonance at 10 picofarad capacitance on our metal plate, and then at the resonance, the ideal power resonance circuit behaves like a infinite resistor. If the LC circuit is exactly at resonance and is neglecting the resistance of the wires involved, then how high will the voltage on the metal plate rise? What I believe is it rises to 10 megavolts, let's say, okay, then the resonant circuit will continuously accumulate electromagnetic energy until the voltage at the antenna plate rises to the same value of the voltage as the transmitter. I know it is weird, but I said I'm going to be radical, so let me go further. We keep in mind that this device is relatively small and is sitting on your backyard. It is not 1 kilohertz quarter wave dipole tower 25 miles tall. There is no huge antenna, so we would not expect to find any huge level of electric power appearing in the circuit. If we weren't aware of the mechanism behind, we will see that the passive LC resonator, which it looks like or seems to burst into the oscillation of its own, of course the voltage grows higher and higher until this thing suffers a corona outbreak or something. Then the lighting bolts shut out. The electromagnetic field near the metal plate grows far stronger than the weak fields already present in the environment. So then our devices on the backyard reassembles an impossible perpetual motion machine. Don't laugh at me. Which might make the physics suspect that this is a hoax. I believe that this is some that the Tesla was expecting to happen. However, the real explanation is completely conventional, and the source of this energy is a unnoticed, the ACE field produced by very distant 10 megavolt transmitter tower. So let's say this phenomenon can only occur for the ideal LC circuit, where the resistance of the coil is zero and where the Q of the circuit is infinite. So if our antenna plate were connected to the resonant secondary of the superconductive Tesla coil, we might in fact see the output voltage grow to the megavolt range. However, in most of the real world Q circuits, it wouldn't reach such height, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I've got a couple of questions. Are you trying to build a high-efficiency antenna at, say, 10 kilohertz? Has anyone, that's question number one, has anyone ever made a cryogenic Tesla coil? Somehow I doubt it, because the Tesla coil itself, the secondary winding, is operating into an extremely high impedance, the free space around it. Therefore, the total amount of current flowing in that secondary coil most of the time is not very big. Therefore, I'd like to believe that that secondary coil tends to run pretty cool. It's not dissipating a lot of power. Therefore, cryogenically cooling it is not going to make a great deal of gain. So, what's the intention? A very low-frequency antenna that launches an E-field or an H-field all by itself? And why would anybody cryogenically cool a Tesla coil? Over to you, Wes.
So the major invention is trying to understand what is happening over there. Any coil is an antenna, and the antenna is a coil, or might be a coil. Any straight piece of wire is a coil, or it's not a coil, but it's a resonant circuit. So let's say anything that is conductive is a resonant circuit. Do you agree with that so far?
I think I do. If you're smart enough, you can take any conductor and make it resonate at some particular frequency.
So, I'm trying to think about the resonant circuit as an antenna and trying to reach the point in which the device in motion can be at the energy level that will be very close to unity and will just need a very little power to be delivered to just work by itself, and that could happen. When you were talking about these two springs and your daughter being on the tray, or any other device of such kind, if we just use a natural wind power or whatever, which wind can damage the Tacoma Bridge at the right frequency, that we will not have a perpetual motion per se, but we will have a motion that it will support itself. So far, you follow me?
I think I am, but I see a problem. By definition, if you and I build an antenna, the whole reason we build an antenna is to send out a signal, to radiate a signal. If you're radiating a signal, you're sending energy into space. If you're sending energy into space, you're not conserving it locally. You can't simultaneously have high Q and radiation.
Can you interact with cosmic ray?
Use cosmic rays somehow to supply the energy? I don't think so.
Use cosmic way to interact with them in any possible way?
Those cosmic rays are so darn random as to when they arrive, the direction of their arrival, the energy of each event, and so on. It's an extremely random event. I think you could do a better job of harnessing the energy of a lightning storm rather than trying to use cosmic rays. But to make an antenna high in Q means it's not radiating. If it's radiating, it can't be high in Q. So you're never going to get a huge buildup of voltage or circulating energy on something that you call an antenna. If it's a shielded structure, and you're keeping all radiation inside, yes, you can build very high Q. But if it's an antenna, by definition, the Q has to be relatively low, otherwise it's not radiating. And if it's not radiating, and you call it an antenna, you're not achieving what I think you want. Over to you, Wes, K2LIW.
Okay. Can it happen that we could somehow, in nuclear magnetic resonance, instead of passively interacting, interact actively? Say, if the example that I mentioned about the crystal of the ferrite, and we see transmutation over there, just by supplying the right frequency at the right time, and it's not only in very low temperature, because they tried in different temperatures, 200 of Kelvin and the temperature of the room. Let me drop. Okay. So, if we could, let's say, have the swing that you were talking about, or Tacoma Bridge or any other structure, and set or filter any energy, possible energy, let's say the wind, to be delivered at the right frequency, just because of steady state device that does not require any maintenance, would it be possible that the small amount of energy to sustain the motion would be fulfilled, that particular requirement? Back to you.
I think you're asking, can you build a very high Q resonator?
Correct.
Yeah, I think there's a very large number of ways of building a high Q resonator. What is your motivation for building the high Q resonator?
Trying to use the energy that is capable of, possible to obtain by any means, in order to create a device that would be able to work with us paying for that source of the energy.
Okay. One of the definitions of Q is the energy stored per cycle divided by the energy dissipated per cycle. If I can make the energy dissipated per cycle very small and the energy stored per cycle very large, by definition, I have high Q. However, the energy that was stored during those cycles, just like my child on the swing, has to come from somewhere.
Okay, not saying that we have a perpetual motion. No, we have a device that simply utilizes the energy that is around us, but it was not coupled to be utilized, and we just found the way to utilize that.
So without a doubt, there is thermal energy, you know, geothermal energy, there's wind energy, there's solar energy, there's tide energy. There's lots of energy available, and if you and I build the right kind of hardware, we can harness that. But it's nice to use that. I wish we were using more renewable energy resources in the United States. But still, it's not perpetual motion. Yes, there are sources of energy that are not now being used that should be used. And I think you're saying you'd like to start using some of those. Go ahead.
Correct. My major question is, do you believe that the precession or the nuclear magnetic resonance could be both active in interaction, not only active to passive interaction, but to
comment? I think the total amount of energy that's present in nuclear magnetic resonance, by the sizes of energy in kilowatt hours that you and I are talking about, I think it's very, very small. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. But don't forget, in nuclear magnetic resonance, we have to have the alignment. You need energy to do that. Without the alignment of the domains, they all cancel each other, and we have no spin that we can collect and amplify. So that's just a thing that you have to have in nuclear magnetic imaging, or just MRI in any way.
Okay, let me give you the example. Okay. We have we have an atom that loses the electron. And though this atom needs to go into the bond, so it acquires the electron from another atom. The energy used to pull out this electron from that atom should be greater than bonds in between the atom, but at the same time, there is another energy that is required to pull out the electron from another atom, which would be the stronger than the bond of that another atom. So far, we're in line.
I think the energy to pull an electron out of an atom, that is, let me think, an endothermic reaction. And when the electron goes back to an atom that was lacking an electron, that's an exothermic reaction. And I think the energy on the way in and the energy on the way out is identical. There's no gain or loss in the big picture, in my opinion.
Well, you need to take out something and then gain something. Now, if those levels are identical in vectoral geometry, you wouldn't be able to do that.
Now, when I create an arc and I'm radiating light and ultraviolet and heat, yes, I'm losing energy. But without the arc, just moving electrons themselves from one atom to another, except for when I'm doing it with current through a copper wire and there's a certain amount of resistance, I mean, at the molecular level, I think there is essentially no loss when you take an electron away or give it back. I think the energy in and the energy out is essentially the same, in my belief.
Vectoral dependency would be you lost something, now you are in need of something, now you got to do the work in order to gain. You spend your money and you have to gain the money. There is always the vector out and vector in. Now, in order to pull out from the perfectly happy atom an electron, you need the energy to do that, right or wrong?
Without a doubt, if you don't have some minimum amount of energy, nothing takes place. In that arcing process that I've described before, that electron moving toward that air molecule that he's about to ionize, he has to have some minimum velocity at the point of impact, and he's got to have enough accuracy in the aiming of the point of impact in order for him to do the job to start the cascading action. Go ahead.
The point is, you get a vector out, you get a electron out. Now, you have to overcome the bonds of the nearby electron, by atom, to get out the electron. So, the force of getting acquiring the electron is stronger than the force of the bonding of that nearby electron to the atom to this electron. Now, because we have a source, and let's say the load, and the load is the light bulb, that's where the electron goes. From one side, we have the earth. Now, this process of exchanging the electron and imbalance of the energy goes down and down to the ground. Now you end up sucking electrons from the ground. Back to you.
I don't think I know what the question is, Wes.
Question is that logic completely false, or that logic could be somehow in line with what you think?
I think I'm not sure.
Because what I think, electrons go from the ground to the device, not from the device to the ground. The ground is the total minus. The load is something that is sucking the energy. The imbalance in the atom, and also not imbalance in the atom because of the lack of the electron exchange of the electron, but because of imbalance of force, because the force of acquiring the electron is stronger than the bonds of the atom that has this electron in order to acquire that. So that will eventually end up in the Earth, and then we're going to be pulling electrons from the Earth. That's my question.
And you made it sound like you think the electron, that the Earth is always the negative terminal.
I don't think so. What I'm saying is just the place where that imbalance is compensated. In other words, is you have to have a delivery of the electrons in order for the load to use them. Back to you.
Question.
Hey, I think the Earth is neutral, and you could have it supply positive charge or negative charge, depending on your experiment. But I think, it maybe has a particular polarity with reference to the ionosphere.
It's negative.
Okay, you think the ionosphere is positive? You might be right, but I'm not sure. John, what were you about to say?
Well, in Wesley's example, when we break an electron loose from an atom, it's going to go to another atom, okay? But that atom has its collection of electrons. Why does it go there?
Oh, you're trying to... that is a good one, John. I like you for that. No, it's not going this way. It's always lack of money that creates a need for the money. It's never money that requires more money. If a person is perfectly happy because he's got a good dinner, he's not going to ask for another dinner. John?
No, but Wesley, if we bombard an atom and break an electron loose, okay, now we have this positively charged atom because it's missing an electron. Where does that electron go?
I believe it's always your wife takes money from you because you have a job. In other words, the load is the one that it creates a request. At first it's taking, and then there is a need to fill the gap. It's never a different way. You're trying to say, okay, first we bombard with another atom, and then we're trying to pull another electron from the atom. No, no. What is happening is the load is sucking the energy, and then lack of the electron is taking place, and then imbalance in the energy level is taking place. Dick?
The example that I give when you start that arc out of a Wim Hof machine is that you create a large enough E field in volts per centimeter such that an arc is possible. A cosmic ray comes along, frees up an electron, that electron goes flying as fast as he can over toward the positive terminal. On the way, he hits another air molecule, ionizes that one. You eventually end up with a whole, chain reaction of electrons moving toward the positive terminal. Those electrons that get to the positive terminal flow through the machine, come back through the negative terminal where the positive ions have been slowly moving. As those positive ions finally get there, and they move kind of slowly, they're lazy guys, when they finally get over to the negative terminal, the electrons that they were lacking get supplied at that time. The negative terminal has got this excess of electrons that have flowed through the machine. He's now supplying them to those positive ions and neutralizing them. But in the process, you've created this ionized path. You've now got this conducting channel. And the rest of the electrons from then on flow through that plasma that you've created. So there's a continuous action of electrons flowing through the machine in a cycle, and they're being gathered over there at the positive terminal, and they're being resupplied at the negative terminal, and you're getting a continuous flow as I see it. So the imbalance, the molecule that lost an electron in a very short period of time, in a couple of nanoseconds, he's about to be satisfied because he's about to reach the supply over there at the negative terminal. K2LIW.
Interesting. I was always picturing the dependency as the air is negative and the ionosphere is more positive. That's why we have a like lightning not going up to the ionosphere, but it's going down to the earth. Back to you.
Both ways.
Sorry, we're over doubling. John, pick up and repeat again.
I said it goes both ways.
Sometimes the bottom of the cloud is negative. Rarely the bottom of the cloud is positive, and those are the really potent lightning bolts. And by the way, that Wimshurst machine, with its arcing effect, doesn't depend on Mother Earth at all. I could operate that thing from a balloon at 100,000 feet. And because of the lower air pressure, I'm going to be using a different portion of the passion curve. But I could still operate that machine far away from the Earth. It doesn't depend on Earth to operate. Over to you, John. I mean, to Wes.
Okay, I wonder what John has as a comment.
I believe then the Wimshurst machine, as you're cranking it, is stripping electrons off of the positive element, passing through the machine, and putting a surplus of electrons on the negative element. And that's what starts the avalanche. But I was speaking of one atom in a group of atoms, and we blast away an electron. Why would it be accepted by another atom?
I think it doesn't. I think the positive ion that you just created now has a strong desire to go to that negative terminal. He goes there and he gets supplied by his missing electron. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, that works for me. It's just, it's amazing. Here again, we're talking about something that's supposed to be so simple and understood by everybody, but there's a lot to it.
For me, it looks like we're getting the supply of the electrons from the Earth. And the higher we go in the altitude, the more positive charge do we have. And the ionosphere and the Earth is a big capacitor. So the electrons flow from the Earth in order to fulfill the need of the electrons because they are being consumed by the load.
Boy, John, any of these processes in physics, whether it be the understanding of a hydrogen atom, an oxygen atom, a uranium atom, the breakdown in the Wimshurst machine, any of these things, as you get deeper and deeper into it. If you think it's simple, you don't understand the problem. Nothing is simple. If you go deep enough into it, nothing is simple. Are there really molecules? That took a while for people to believe it. Are there really atoms? That took a while to believe it. Are the atoms are made out of subparticles, protons, neutrons, and electrons? Took a long time to believe that. Are the protons and neutrons made out of something else? It's taken us a long time to believe that. And do we think those quarks are the end of the story? I'll be amazed if I think that's the end of the story. There's got to be more to it. If you think it's simple, you don't understand the problem. I don't think the Earth has to supply the electrons to make these machines to work. And somehow the weather, let me drop. Somehow the weather is charging that ionosphere. I don't know how. Otherwise it would discharge itself and stay neutral from then on. And as a conductor, as a capacitor, it's a very loose capacitor. I mean, you go up there with your spaceship into what you think is the ionosphere, and you try to measure the local conductivity by earthbound standards, that's an extremely low conductivity. There's a lot of spacing between all of those molecules in the ionosphere. It's the large amount of spacing between all of them that gives them a very long mean free path. that allows them not to get neutralized in a hurry. You go down to the lower atmosphere, the ultraviolet rays from the sun are hitting the lower atmosphere and breaking them up into a plasma, but they rejoin real fast because they're real close to each other. So, yeah, the ionosphere is there, and it is a ionized layer. It is a plasma.